abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Friday, February 14th, 2014. Talking about Franklin Roosevelt today. You get the standard view of Franklin Roosevelt everywhere you look. You get it in school. You get it in books. You get it on television. You get it in the movies. You get it everywhere. Thanks to Franklin Roosevelt, we conquered the Depression. Now, you do get some historians, even some mainstream and left liberal historians, honest enough to say, all right, obviously, the New Deal did not lift us out of the Depression. All you have to do is look at the unemployment figures. But he gave us hope and all that, this, that, and the other thing. And World War II got us out of the Depression. Well, that's not true either, but that's for another day. I have a special page on that, by the way, the old World War II got us out of the Depression myth. You can check that out at libertyclassroom.com/war. And I have a chapter on that in my book, 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. But today, we're going to talk about the New Deal and what it did with historian Bert Folsom. Bert Folsom, F-O-L-S-O-M. Bert Folsom is a professor of history who holds the Charles F. Klein Chair in History and Management at Hillsdale College. He is the author of The Myth of the Robber Barons, A New Look at the Rise of Big Business in America, an indispensable book. It really, really is an eye-opening book, The Myth of the Robber Barons. Also, FDR Goes to War, How Expanded Executive Power, Spiraling National Debt, and Restricted Civil Liberties Shaped Wartime America. That book is from just last year. And then finally, the book we're talking about today, New Deal or Raw Deal, How FDR's Economic Legacy Has Damaged America. Bert Folsom, welcome to the program.
Well, it's good to be with you.
You know, Bert, I remember years ago, I guess back in 2009, remember you and I were on Glenn Beck at the same time on a split screen, and you were talking about New Deal or Raw Deal, and I was talking about Meltdown, and Glenn said he had read them both over the weekend, and I thought, well, I'm not so sure I buy that. But then he was extracting ideas from these books that were not in the press packet. So therefore, he had to have read them. And I thought, well, I kind of respect that he managed to do that.
Well, we had a good time with that, Tom. I remember that. It was split screen. And so the two of us, we didn't have a chance to chat at all or talk with each other, but we played off of the material very well. Both of us have tremendous historical interest in the 1930s and, of course, connecting it with the issues today. So that was a good session. I enjoyed that.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, Bert, to be perfectly honest with you, when your book came out, I kind of thought to myself, we have Jim Powell's book and then Bob Murphy came out with a book on the Great Depression and the New Deal, and Tom DiLorenzo has done some good work. Then we have John T. Flynn's old book, and I frankly wondered, well, how much more is there to dig up? And boy, was I ever wrong, as I've told anybody who cared to listen ever since. You dug up such great stuff, that's why I wanted to have you on today. I want to start off by reading
you
a passage from your own book. And
okay.
In this passage, you are quoting Henry Steele Commager and Richard Morris, who were totally mainstream historians. And boy, does it show. I was just so creeped out at this passage when I first read this book. When I was flipping through this morning before you and I spoke, I found that I had bracketed off this passage and put a big exclamation mark next to it. So let me read it to you.
Sure.
Here they are summarizing Franklin Roosevelt and his whole mystique. It is the stuff of good history, this, a leadership that was buoyant and dynamic, a large program designed to enable the government to catch up with a generation of lag and solve the problems that crowded upon it, a people quickened into resolution and self-confidence, a nation brought to realize its responsibilities and its potentialities. How it lends itself to drama. The sun rises on a stricken field. The new leader raises the banner and waves it defiantly at the foe. His followers crowd about him. Armies of recruits emerge from the shadows and throng into the ranks. The bands play, the flags wave, the army moves forward, and soon the sound of battle and the shouts of victory are heard in the distance. In perspective, we can see that it was not quite like that, but that was the way it seemed at the time. Bert, I'm not going to make any editorial comment on that. I want you to do so.
Well, for that generation of liberals, the 1930s was a golden opportunity to grow government. And we saw, and bring academics into the political arena. So Ray Moley and Rexford Tugwell, the brains trusters at Columbia University, others brought in. The AAA was designed by Professor Black, or in part at least by Professor Black at Harvard, also by some people at Montana State. So you had college professors designing programs, active, and the fact that we know now is that those programs didn't work. They were often counterproductive. But at the time, for academics who believe that government, that private enterprise creates problems and government solves it, that was an enormously great period for them, the 1930s and Franklin Roosevelt.
This rhetoric, though, coming from these historians is so striking. It's interesting how many people, how many Americans say, gosh, how could people ever have developed such a cult of personality around the fascist dictators or whatever, some two-bit third world guy? And yet, listen to the way they spoke about Franklin Roosevelt like he's a demigod.
Right.
It's so beneath a free people. I want to talk about, though, some of the alphabet soup agencies and some of the programs. I want to start off with the National Recovery Administration, because here you've got so much great new material. So can you first explain what was the purpose of this? And then I want to talk about what you found in the tire industry as a classic example of what this program turned out to be in practice.
Right. The National Recovery Act, that's the old NRA, was designed to allow businesses to set prices for products. And those prices would be legalized, and it would be illegal to give a discount to a customer. And the argument for this was that the competition that was ensuing between businesses was causing problems with the businesses to survive, and so businesses would fail, and then that would increase unemployment. And so if you allowed businesses to charge a lot for their products, that would give them profits and keep people employed. Of course, that's utter silliness, and it's so unconstitutional, as the Supreme Court later decided in a 9-0 vote, that it was unconstitutional. But nonetheless, we had about 500 industries that came forth and had codes, NRA codes, that would set the prices of products, it would set wages for their employees, and those people in the industry, those businesses, had to charge those prices for the products.
So in the tire industry, you give a great example of what this actually meant for the small businessman. Why was this not just a general boon for business in general?
Right. That's a good question. It would look like it was completely a boon for business in general, but it wasn't. It was for bigger businesses. The smaller businesses ended up hurting. The tire industry is a good example, and that's why I went through that. By the way, the NRA, there is no real NRA archives, but we have in the William Borah papers in the Library of Congress tremendous amounts of material that's untapped largely about businesses complaining and talking about the problems with the NRA. The tire industry is a classic example. Here you have a situation where the larger tire industries, I'm talking about Goodyear, for example, or Goodrich, and Firestone, they have a national market. So what happened, if you have to charge, for example, $20, let's just say it's $20 for a tire, and the prices are set at $20, the small tire producer who is located, say, in Austin, Texas, he produces his tires for $20, but he can't give a discount. So Firestone comes in at $20, he comes in at $20, and then Firestone, right after that, says, by the way, if you buy our tires, we promise national servicing, whether you're in San Francisco, whether you're in Austin, Texas, Houston, or Boston, Massachusetts, we have a national distributorship, and we can service any tire that goes bad, so you ought to buy from us. Well, the local tire dealers can't offer that kind of pitch, and they can't compete by giving a discount. And so they end up going broke, and we have more unemployment after the NRA than we did before.
And, you know, you quote somebody, I don't remember his name, I don't think it's important, from the tire industry, a small businessman, making exactly this point at the time. So people recognized at the time what was going on. This wasn't just in retrospect that historians realized, you know what, this actually favored the bigger businesses. They saw it at the time, which is why Clarence Darrow, in his investigation of the NRA the next year, called it wolfish. He had this whole list of horrifying adjectives to describe the actual operation of the NRA.
That's one of the few times I agree with Clarence Darrow.
Right.
He had that pegged. He saw the damage that was being done to small business, and he did what he could to undermine the National Recovery Act in the official position he had to hear claims made by small businessmen. The act is utterly ridiculous. It is unconstitutional. It is totally anti-American, and it failed abysmally.
Now, Bert, they had to suspend the antitrust laws to get away with these sorts of industry-wide price controls, or at the very least, they were minimum prices set. But what was the economic rationale behind it? I mean, it looks preposterous, but why? Surely they had some reason for doing it.
Right. Again, the idea here is that if you allow businesses to set prices, they won't lay anybody off. And they're going to pay good wages because those will be parts of the NRA codes. And so, therefore, everybody's going to be happy. What that omits is, as I say, that people will end up being unemployed in the case of the tire industry. Small businessmen that are right on the edge can't afford to charge very high prices because part of the reasons that they are able to compete is because they say, hey, we'll give you a discount if you'll come with us rather than the bigger dealer who has a better reputation. We'll give you a discount if you come over here with us. Now, in the case of the NRA codes, if you charged rates for your product that were underneath the code rates, you could go to jail. And I cite in the New Deal or Raw Deal, the book, examples of people who either were threatened and they lost court cases and almost went to jail or who did go to jail.
Now, another part of the NRA codes were minimum wages, relatively high minimum wages. So this, of course, no doubt drove some people out of the labor market altogether. And so I guess it leads to the question, suppose I do manage to keep my job even in the face of these relatively high minimum wages. If the idea is that we want minimum wages so that the workers will have purchasing power and so on if they manage to get a job at all.
Exactly.
Isn't that offset by the fact that everything I go to buy is at an artificially high price because of these codes?
You're exactly right, Tom. These are parts of the unintended consequences. You can't set high prices for products without having negative consequences on the consumers who are buying these products. And also then it leads you to want to buy foreign. And so what happens then is we have to have high tariffs to keep cheaper foreign goods out of our country that would be able to successfully compete with those products that are set high by the NRA codes. So then we have countries that retaliate against us because we won't buy their tires or whatever. And so now our auto industry, which is very competitive internationally, is being tariffed off in Europe because we won't buy products made by other countries because of the NRA code. In other words, there's spillover effects that make this an economic disaster.
Let's talk about probably the easiest one of all in terms of persuading the general public that it was a bad idea, and that, of course, is the Agricultural Adjustment Act. I think almost anybody today will admit that was a bad idea. So tell us about it exactly. First, how it got what it did in the first year of its existence when you already had all this production and it was too late to impose acreage controls, and then what did it do later?
Right. Well, it's interesting what you just said, Tom. You said it's almost indefensible, and you're right. In the academic world, I very rarely encounter someone that wants to step up and say, I want to defend the AAA, in part because you're paying farmers not to produce, and you're telling them to cut back on their production. Well, you can't get out of a depression by producing less and paying people not to produce. It's obvious. And so it's on its very surface, it's not going to help the economy. However, variations of the AAA are still in effect today, lingered on for a long time. And that's because if you give groups in the economy, like farmers, a subsidy, even if the subsidy is counterproductive to the economy, the farmers are reluctant to give up their subsidy, and politicians then end up going along with it in future administrations, which shows why it's bad to get these programs in, Tom, to begin with, because it's very hard to get rid of programs, even bad ones, once they are established.
Even if they harm the whole public, basically, the point is that they, in a concentrated way, benefit a few who have the incentive to lobby for them 24 hours a day, and you and I don't have an incentive to lobby against them, and so they persist. Well, what happened in 1933 specifically, though? What did they do with all this production that they had that was supposedly, well, not supposedly, that was indeed pushing prices lower than they wanted them to be?
Right. You have farmers that cut out a fourth. They're paid roughly $10 an acre. It varies from crop to crop, to take their land out of production. In the case of hogs, as you know, Tom, they were required to slaughter hogs because they had to take them out of circulation. So, again, you're paying people to eliminate food from the economy.
They're destroying things.
Right. And that's not going to end up in recovering from a depression. And, of course, when Governor Landon ran against this in the 1936 election on the Republican ticket, Roosevelt quickly said, so are you going to eliminate the farmers program that I have given them? And he said, oh, well, no, we'll just run it more efficiently.
Ah, the story of the Republican Party.
And so they were going to run it more efficiently. Well, who are you, if you're a farmer, are you going to vote for the guy who gave you a subsidy or his opponent who says, no, I will make the subsidy more efficient? Well, Roosevelt, as you know, carried all but two states. He won the Electoral College against Landon, 523-8. So what I'm saying, Tom, is in the face of just the two programs we've mentioned so far today, the NRA, the National Recovery Act, and the AAA, the Agricultural Adjustment Act, those two programs, both with terrible negative consequences, Roosevelt ran on those programs saying, yeah, I'm glad I passed them. And he got 523 electoral votes, and his opponent got 8.
Bert, let's talk about the Tennessee Valley Authority, because that, by contrast, is a program that almost everybody will defend and say, now look, this one, even you, you crazy conservatives and libertarians have got to support or at least admit that it worked. What was the TVA, and did it so-called work?
Right. It's a subsidy to the Tennessee Valley. And the idea here is that you have a good river system, and it could generate cheap electricity. And so we'll give them a subsidy in that area, and they will then have the cheap electricity. Of course, it's just, in other words, taxing most of the nation to give to Tennessee, Kentucky, and Alabama. And so the senators from those states, Alvin Barkley was the majority leader. He's from Kentucky. You had two very senior Democratic senators from Tennessee and also from Alabama. So the political influence is we're going to carve out a subsidy for our states, for the river systems in our states, to improve them, to generate hydroelectricity and dams and this sort of thing in our states. And the taxpayers will end up paying for it.
So what's the outcome? Didn't this actually bring electrification to the Tennessee Valley? I mean, it did what it said it was going to do, right?
Well, it did. I taught in that area for a while, and there were a lot of people who said, boy, my grandparents said they didn't have electricity before. And now after we do. What's interesting is that those areas that had the subsidized electricity ended up remaining in rural economies. They had less incentive to become industrial, to innovate with new industries, to venture into new enterprises. And so we find that North Carolina, for example, which didn't have any TVA money at all, ended up developing better economically than Tennessee did, because Tennessee, in effect, had an incentive not to people had an incentive to stay put. We've got subsidized electricity. We don't need to venture into new programs quite as easily. It ended up, oddly enough, slowing down the very areas that received the subsidy.
What about the claim, though, that, look, Folsom, you can make all the complaints that you want about Franklin Roosevelt, but I remember my granddaddy got a job with the WPA, and that's what got his family through the 1930s.
I think that's one of the arguments that has been used most effectively over the years in defense of the New Deal. And in fact, my father-in-law was in that category, and there was really no way that I was ever able to reach him, because what he's saying is, I did not have a job before Franklin Roosevelt. Then Roosevelt came in, and now I do have a job, which in his case was true because he was from Kentucky. And Alvin Barkley, again, being the majority leader, brought a lot of pork into Kentucky, the TBA being one example, and then he was able to get a job. What you have to look at is the bigger picture, and the bigger picture is that you have to have higher taxes to afford all these subsidies. And higher taxes meant that the tax rate, the top rate, which was 25% in 1932, income tax rate, went up to 79% by 1935. Once you get taxed, and of course it ultimately would go over 90% a few years later. And so what you have is rich people who were formerly able to keep three-fourths of everything they made and reinvested in the economy, now all of a sudden had no incentive to reinvest. They took their money, they put it into tax-exempt bonds, they put it into stamp collections, coin collections, foreign investments, all sorts of other things, art collections that did not generate wealth for the American economy. So what you did is, by having these programs that didn't work, you gave people jobs for which there really was no demand, and then you took the money to do that and made it so that rich people had no incentive to invest in the American economy, and that perpetuates the Great Depression, and it's why it was the worst 10-year period in American history, the 1930s, when we had the Great Depression and had these programs.
Bert, what about the political angle in terms of the disbursement of WPA programs around the country? Do you go for this thesis according to which they were dispersed not according to need, but according to, let's say, other calculations?
Yes, that's very interesting, Tom, because what we see, as you know, is that once you get the power to give these subsidies to either congressional groups or, in some cases, the president had this power as well, when you start allocating that power, immediately it is used for political purposes, not really for economic purposes, in at least to steer money into areas that need economic development. No, it went right for political purposes right away. Roosevelt targeted those states that he wanted to carry in future elections. Those states received the massive bulk of the federal funds. We can document this, and I did that in the book, New Deal or Raw Deal. We see states like Pennsylvania, Vermont, and the results of those states and specific counties in those states receiving massive amounts of federal funds, and how they then voted Democratic and allowed Roosevelt to carry 46 out of 48 states in 1936.
And of course, what need would he have had to spread a lot of programs down there in the South when the South wasn't going to vote for a Republican? You know, if it was Christ himself, I mean, basically, that was what it would have taken for them to vote Republican at that point. And yet they're the poorest and they get the least relief. Let me read a quotation from page 174 of your book. This is from Senator Daniel Hastings, Republican of Delaware. All appreciate the difficulty Republican candidates generally are confronted with and the large sums of money being used at least indirectly by the New Deal for campaign purposes. He went on to say that he predicted that this indirect bribery of the voters will be overcome. I cannot believe the American people are willing to be sold that way. Well, I wish I couldn't believe it, but I'm afraid I've lived through it.
Right. We saw that, indeed, that many were willing to be bought. And Al Smith, former governor of New York, said it best when he said, nobody shoots Santa Claus. And that's sort of what Roosevelt was able to demonstrate, that you come in with the promise of a program, maybe a real program, and maybe the promise of a future program, and you can get votes from areas. Then you try to tax the rich to pay for these areas, these programs, and although you lose their votes, you get the votes of other people who hope to get the money, the tax money, for projects in their district.
Now, Bert, I just want to know, did any of your critics on this book come at you with the following sort of argument? Did anybody say, look, we will concede that unemployment was an intractable problem during the 30s, although it did get better under Franklin Roosevelt than it had been in the past. But the fact is, we did begin to see some recovery. We did get economic growth. And the fact is, before Franklin Roosevelt, we didn't have the New Deal. After him and during his presidency, we did. And so it seems unreasonable to attribute the economic growth that we did see to anything other than the New Deal itself.
Well, then I'd have to ask, Tom, where is this economic growth that we're getting? Because I can see lots of economic stagnation. For example, in the 1930s, we never had a year in the 1930s that had patents that were as high as they were in the late 20s. The amount of innovation drops considerably. In the 1920s, we get the beginnings of air conditioning. We get the zipper. You know, we get all sorts of inventions on Dixie cups and things like that for purposes of sanitation. We get a decline in disease. We get life expectancy increasing 5 to 6 years during the 1920s. It goes down in the 1930s. See, in other words, the 1930s is way overrated for innovation. We had lower life expectancy after two terms of Franklin Roosevelt than we did in 1932 when he was elected. And yet in the 1920s, we had an increase in life expectancy of almost 6 years. So what we see is a disaster. We had murder rates go up. If you look at the data between 1900 and 1960, the seven worst years of murder rates were all in the 1930s, between 1900 and 1960. You have suicide rates increasing. Unemployment is hard on people. We had very little innovation. We had very little economic development. It was a disastrous decade.
You know, your former colleague at Hillsdale College, Bob Murphy, has a take on this in which he says that looking at every previous economic downturn in American history, you find no new deal that followed it. I mean, mostly the government did little to nothing in case after case. And eventually the market adjusted itself. So
right, Bob is right.
Yeah, so the question isn't
right.
Yeah, the question isn't would there have been a recovery or would there not? There was always a recovery, but why was this one the most drawn out in American history when it just so happens that it had the most government involvement? I mean, could you imagine if it had been the opposite? If all the downturns had been followed by New Deals, and then the only one where you and I were in charge during it, and we didn't do anything, and then the economy just stagnated for a decade, they'd never let us hear the end of that.
No, you're exactly right. As we know, correlation does not equal an absolute truth, but there is that correlation.
Right.
And that is that that in previous depressions, like the Panic of 1893, the Panic of 1873, for example, we had very little government activity, and we were out of the problem in about three years. Sometimes it was as much as 5 years. 3 to 5 years, we were out of the problem. And then we get the Great Depression, and I think people thought when Hoover went through it that probably we'd be out of it in Roosevelt's first or second year, because that would be 4 or 5 years. But it kept going, and it kept going, and it kept going, and Roosevelt kept doing more and more programs, and then we had a depression within the depression, and unemployment actually went up during 1937 and 38. I begin the book in 1939 when unemployment is at 20.7%, and Secretary of Treasury Henry Morgenthau says, my gosh, we've been doing this for 7 years and nothing seems to be working.
Well, Bert, we're going to leave it there, but I'll tell you, this is such an important book and it's interesting to read. I mean, you dug up some juicy quotations from these people, from the good guys and the bad guys alike. And I strongly urge people to check this out, New Deal or Raw Deal, How FDR's Economic Legacy Has Damaged America. We'll have to have you back on in a couple of months when your next book is out.
I would like that very much, Tom. I've enjoyed getting to know you over the years, and I wish you the best with your show.
Thanks so much, Bert. All right, everybody, you can check out Bert at BertFolsom.com. Again, F-O-L-S-O-M, BertFolsom.com. The book we've been talking about is New Deal or Raw Deal. You know, past couple of programs, I've been saying something that's patently false because I had a couple of different speaking events mushed together in my brain. I know Liberty University's in Virginia. Like, if I didn't know that, I wouldn't mind admitting that to you. But the weird thing is, I do know that. I know a lot about Liberty University, and I keep saying South Carolina. I don't know why. So anyway, March 1st is College of Southern Idaho in terms of my events that are open to the public. March 5th, Washburn University in Topeka, Kansas. March 15th, the University of Central Arkansas. Then April 9th, I'm going to be at Florida Southern College in Lakeland, Florida. And then April 10th, I'll be at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. We got it right. You can get the details about these events on my events page on my personal site, TomWoods.com. The events page is TomWoods.com/events. Remember, we are hitting episode number 100 of this program next week on Tuesday with Judge Andrew Napolitano answering your questions. I've already talked to the judge. That one is taped and in the can, and we're going to be airing it on Tuesday. So thank you for your questions. I can't take any more until the next time I have the judge on. He's got a new book coming out. He tells us all about it. It sounds absolutely killer. It is so important. Wait till you hear about it. And then finally, remember, you guys, as listeners of this program, you guys get a special discount at mylibertyclassroom.com where you can be a cool guy like Bert Folsom or Kevin Gutzman or Peter Schiff. You can learn history and economics and all this stuff super, super well just while you're driving your car at libertyclassroom.com. You get a discount with coupon code SHOW in all caps. So please check that out. And remember, you're helping us out. Every time you enter Amazon through our little Amazon widget at TomWoodsRadio.com, you're helping me pay the bills here associated with this program, which I hope you guys are enjoying. Enjoy your long weekend. We'll be here. You won't be working on Monday, but I sure will. We'll be ranking the presidents on this program on Monday, so don't miss it. Thanks for listening.
The Tom Woods Show.